Good morning. Those of you who come regularly notice that our colors have morphed, at least two of us. Those of you who are on our email mailing list understand that David and I spent a week in Assisi, Italy, just past, invited there by Swami Kriyananda, the founder of Ananda, for an initiation ceremony that brought both of us into a new spiritual reality. For all these years of Ananda, there has been a singular Swami. Swami means teacher. It's a title, not actually a name. Swami Kriyananda. Kriyananda is his spiritual name and Swami is his title. And now there are more than one Swami at Ananda. There are actually 23 counting him, and David and I are among them. This initiation represents a reformation of what Yogananda calls an autobiography of a yogi, the ancient Swami order. One of the chapters in the autobiography is, I join the ancient Swami order. And he describes, Yogananda describes, how his guru, being a member of that ancient order, was able to initiate him, and how it was a vow of complete dedication to God. And in the traditional order, almost all Swamis are unmarried. It's a singular lifestyle. Swami Kriyananda, for many years, as he said, has not wanted to be the only Swami at Ananda. But the question of people having life partners had always been a stumbling block. And then, this last June, and really what came to him as a divine revelation, he felt that he was divinely inspired to reform the ancient order by creating what he calls now the Naya Swami order. Naya simply means new. And one of the conditions of that is that having a life partner is not does not preclude you from taking this vow of renunciation. Of course, oneself and one's marriage partner have to be at a particular stage of life together to be able to move into what is really such an impersonal way of relating. But inasmuch as the ideal of renunciation is to unite us ever more deeply with all there is no reason that that partnership would preclude that dedication as long as the understanding between you is strong and clear and even. So, Swamiji, once he made that decision, he said it was pretty easy because he looked around and he saw within the 40 years of Ananda community many individuals, or at least some individuals, who were strong enough in their inner understanding for him to be able to launch this. So he had the first initiation ceremony on Friday a week ago, and there were eight of us, nine from America, and a number of others from Assisi, who live in Assisi. Some of them were Americans, and so we went through this initiation ceremony. The color for Naya Swamis is this color, blue, that we're wearing. So as a symbol of this change, this is what you'll see here. If any of you are interested in this order, which also includes a postulate level, you can speak to us. Unlike everything else at Ananda, where you have to be invited to join, this is self-selected. And this is also not defined by Ananda, which is to say, other things that we've done are defined by your life in the community, but this is not. This transcends Ananda. So any of you who feel a deep sense of dedication, but for one reason or another are not active in the community life or even the Sangha life, does not preclude you. Now, I wanted to say all of that. I should also add, since everyone asks, Swamiji himself is radiantly happy. His health is very good, extremely good, and he was transcendently blissful at the inauguration of this order. And those of us who were there felt like we just stepped into another reality. In fact, we joked a lot. Every group of beings has a name. You have a gaggle of geese, you have a school of fish, you have a flock of birds. So we had to decide, when you have a group of Naya Swamis together, what do you have? And we decided we have a void. That's what you have. You have nothing. So it's actually become the noun to describe. We went around in a big van together, which we, of course, called the Voidmobile. And every time we became confused about what we were doing, we declared chaos in the void and then went forward from there. So nothing has changed our humor. Today's topic is about karma and about how one needs to live in order to have what one desires. And it seemed to me that the subject of renunciation and karma go hand in hand together. You know, early in my spiritual life, when I would read of the extremes of renunciation that has characterized Kali Yuga, which is the age of matter that this planet is just coming out of, one of the reasons Swamiji felt that it was time to reform this order is that the Swami order was created during Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga on this planet has been a time when the consciousness of humanity in general is defined by the form of things. And so if you think in terms of renunciation, as we have all known it, it all comes out of Kali Yuga. It's all based on wearing very different clothes, living in a very different lifestyle, you know, in the most extreme cases, going into perpetual seclusion, walling yourself off in a cave and having the food just slip through the doors. Very extreme situations are described. And the whole attitude is all about what you can't have, what you have to push away. And that was a very appropriate attitude during the age of Kali Yuga, in which the grip that the material world had on people's consciousness, it was the only thing they could understand. Everything was about form. And if you couldn't achieve anything unless you changed the form of things. But now we're moving into an age of energy. Not yet quite into an age of pure consciousness, but more into energy. So people are able to understand, even scientists, and our whole world view is shifting to realize that it's not so much the form of things that count, it's the energy and the consciousness behind it. It's the attitude with which we do things rather than the things themselves. And the way Swami describes it, in the age of matter, the only way you could make any effort to diminish the hold that the ego has on our consciousness is to deny the ego all the things that it wants. You know, anything that the ego is inclined toward, then we cut that out of our lives. And in that way, the hope is that the ego itself will diminish in its dominance in our awareness. The ego, Yogananda described, is the infinite soul identified with the single physical body. It's a very, very interesting definition, because from that illusion of singularity and separateness, every other sense of limitation comes. We fear we fear death, we fear illness, we fear loneliness, we fear old age, we fear the scorn of others, we fear lack, and we develop envy, we become anxious about our own fate. If we knew ourselves to be merely a drop in the great ocean, just think about it. If you were a single drop in the ocean and you knew yourself to be that, you wouldn't really be walking around wondering what the ocean is going to do and what's going to become of you. We would just ride that ocean and feel this great force with its own power and its own reality, and we would just be a little part of that. One year when I was still living at Ananda Village and my responsibilities were for the guests at the Expanding Light, and we had a weekend, I think actually it was about the chakras, it doesn't really matter, but we were thinking in terms of the different levels of inner consciousness, and I took the group in the summer down to the Yuba River. And the Yuba River is, parts of it especially are in a very deep canyon. And we were out there, and I think we were still doing exercises, and so there are all these granite rocks, and we were lying out like this on the granite rocks and trying to feel ourselves one with the earth element, which is the security and power of the first chakra. And we were lying there like that, looking up this deep canyon, and way up there was this eagle, or what looked to me like an eagle. It might have just been a hawk, or maybe it was a pigeon, but it was a bird. Suddenly I was less sure of myself. All this time I've declared it was an eagle, but I have no idea what it was. It was just up there. It was far away, and it was completely different than us lying on those rocks. And I just had one of those moments that you can often have in nature where I hardly transcended myself, but certainly the hold that my identification with this individual body had on me dissolved into the rock and even dissolved into the bird. And I thought, oh, how, just all you have to do is switch your perspective. You know, just if I'm looking at myself from the perspective of that bird and just see this little tiny speck, a little too big to eat, but nonetheless had that potential, you know, just lying there and then just flew off, how different everything would be. Isn't that so? And the only thing that keeps us from actually knowing that, having it be more than just a temporary glimpse or a romantic fantasy, is the fact that we have become so deeply identified with the experiences tied to this one individuality that we literally just can't break loose. It's such a habit. We call it our nature. We call it our personality, but it isn't. It's just a very, very old habit. The ego is nothing but a very old habit. That's not to say it's so easy to escape. You know, people talk these days, and it's a very popular thought, oh, I create my own reality. In fact, Swami Kriyananda, who's been talking a lot lately about master's predictions, about, you know, difficult economic times and social times and very hard times that are coming to us, which many prophetic statements or prophets and prophecies are talking about. You know, 2012 has become the new Y2K. And everybody's really interested to see how this all plays out. Well, some people say, don't talk about negative things. After all, we create our own reality. Well, sort of. We create our own response to what happens. But do we really create our own reality? I mean, go home and look at the gray hair and try to make it not gray. Okay? Go home and, you know, look at the garbage that you forgot to take out and try to make it disappear. You know, look at the job that you don't like and try to make it into something you like. Whatever it is that you have and don't have, we have the capacity to choose our response. But as Swamiji puts it so perfectly, he says, yes, this world is a dream, but it's God's dream, it's not our own. When you're in your own dream and you're sound asleep, you can make it any way you want. But even then, watch, it's compelled by whatever you have already programmed yourself to be. And that's what Paul is saying so simply there. He doesn't use the word karma. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. Isn't that just the simplest thought? Whatever causes you have set in motion, they become the reality for the minute that follows the one you just created. And all those minutes of acting from egoic consciousness, and I don't mean egotism and self-interest necessarily, but just the simple thought that what I do it. This, the little bubble, the wave on the sea, the most powerful image to understand the illusions that we have and the truth of what we have is the wave on the sea. Because the wave is so big, it seems to have all this energy. It goes places, it does things. But you see, if there were no ocean behind it, there could never be a wave. And no matter how much that wave moves and jumps and comes in with the tide and goes out with the tide and smashes on the rocks and or whatever it does so beautifully, it absolutely never loses its absolute identity with that ocean. And where we live on the spectrum of consciousness, this dream goes on. This ocean is God's consciousness, the divine consciousness playing out. Our choice is what level of reality we choose to tune into. Do we see ourselves as one with this body and everything about this body is the most important thing to us? Many people who are very matter-bound define their freedom as the ability to engage in anything this body wants to do. We drink, we eat, we have enormous sexual experiences, we dominate others, we have personal power, and we call this great freedom. Look what I can do. But as ye sow, so shall ye reap. And even though, as Yogananda describes, the thwarting cross currents of ego can allow us to sort of push our wave up and seem to be making great progress toward the beach, sooner or later the power of the sea is going to grab us and pull us back, isn't it? I was one year we were in Costa Rica, I think, and I was snorkeling in this little cove. I was by myself, and I was just having a very good time, just sort of looking around, and I very foolishly, completely just lost track of where I was and what the ocean was doing, but the ocean did not lose track of me. I lived without the cosmic sea, but it was not bereft of me, to quote Yogananda's poem Samadhi. And it just picked me up out of nowhere and threw me against the rock. Fortunately, I was faced in such a way that it was my lower body, not my head, that hit the rock, or I might not be here talking to you. But it just threw me against that rock, and it was... I staggered out, and I was all bloody. I mean, you know, we're at this beautiful resort, and this sort of shocked girl comes with all this blood dripping down. It was not really what most of the vacationers wanted to see, but it was a very salutary lesson for me, not only in stupidity when you're snorkeling, but just how we think we're so free and independent, but you know, we're always just that little bubble in the sea. And we have to ride. The only freedom we have really is as a surfer. We can stand up on that wave and ride it where it takes us, and ride it joyfully where it takes us. Now, we're coming back, you know, to the new reality that we're living here. You know, why would a person choose to step farther into this? I mean, many people looking at the life that we've lived all these years would say, well, you know, how much farther do you go? But you see, the farther that we're going is not really defined by the color that we wear or the house that we live in or the style of our of anything like that. That's not the reality of it. We have the example of Swami Kriyananda in our lives. When people say, well, what does it mean to be a Swami? I say, well, we've been looking at one this whole time. You know, it's about transcending that sense of identity with the limited self. And it does help. We can't kid ourselves. We can't play this game, which there was a very, very popular spiritual teacher about 30 years ago who, like many of very, very popular spiritual teachers who were bringing a false teaching and therefore a very popular one, gradually he imploded and the whole thing went nowhere. But his teaching was a marvelous one. His was, just do whatever you feel like doing and then call it spiritual. And so that's what they all did. You know, they were drinking and having promiscuous sexual relationships, and they were ego dominant, and they were partying, and they were getting lots of money, and they just called it spiritual. And everybody walked around being spiritual, being exactly as they were. And really, frankly, Americans were so dumb, they thought it was a real true teaching. But it wasn't. And then after a time, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. The affirmation of separateness gradually just fragmented the whole thing into pieces, right? Because what we really need to be doing at all times is working to break that sense of identity. And yes, it's not just about the form, it is about inner consciousness, but let's not kid ourselves, the forms also matter. You know, the extent to which we seek our happiness by trying to take that wave farther from the ocean, that simply defines the distance in which that wave is going to fall. When someone once asked Yogananda what was the difference between himself and everyone else, you know, interestingly, he described it in the reverse of what you would think. You would think that Paramhansa Yogananda, great master from India, the guru of millions, the avatar for this age, all of that causes you to see his individual form just rising bigger and bigger. Don't you think of it like that? And if you're thinking of waves on the ocean, you would say, well, Yogananda was like a tidal wave sweeping over the city of Los Angeles. It would just get huger and huger. But he says, I'm just a bulge on the surface of the ocean, he called himself. Because the more spiritually advanced a person becomes, the closer they are to the ocean. And the less and less their individual wave separates itself out. It's a very interesting reality in Swami's commentary on this particular reading. He says, you know, God doesn't care about our worldly success. As he put it in another place, he says, when we die and go to heaven, the angels don't gather around and say, oh, here comes the man who owns 6 railroads. You know, the angels don't cheer because his stock portfolio was so impressive when he died. You know, it just doesn't make any difference. In fact, we were enjoying the reality of this, the Naya Swamis, and we were saying, you know, This is not based on being competent. You know, you don't have to be competent. You know, to have a position, perhaps managing one of Ananda's colonies, it's helpful if you have a little bit of skill in how to manage a colony. It helps, doesn't it? You know, in any institution, in any organized system, you tend to try to get people at least to have some idea how to do the job they're doing, right? Or bring something to it. But our dedication to God has absolutely nothing to do with anything except our ability, and most especially our profound desire, to break that sense of identity with the individual self and to live entirely in the ocean, even if God moves your wave around. You see, that's the interesting reality of Swami Kriyananda, who for many years, for many people, was so confusing because he would often stand up on a regular basis. He would stand up in community meetings and even public talks and so on, and he would enumerate for us all the really good things he'd been doing recently. I wrote this book, and then I wrote this book, and then I wrote this book, and then I recorded these television programs, then I did these songs, then we had this concert, and then we designed this building. He'd go like that. And you would think, especially in the early years, people would think, you know, he's just all he does is brag about what he's accomplished. But I gradually came to appreciate, you know, his enthusiasm was like that of a child. You know how little children come and say, "Mommy, Mommy, look what I made." I remember, this is like a karmic memory. Master says, the things that we do before the age of 6 are often a reflection of who we were in the past lives. That's why you'll see little girls will wrap themselves in little scarves and they'll say, "Mommy, watch me dance," you know, and they'll dance like this. And there'll just be such a seriousness about it. We all find it so charming. Well, it's been asserted, and I believe it's true, that especially young children are reliving the memory of what they really did seriously before. And so their intense seriousness about it is because inwardly they have years of training behind them and they're expressing it because their consciousness is that. It's only their body that doesn't cooperate. And I remember when I was about 4, my friend and I made sculptures. And we made them out of mud. And then I wanted my mother to cast it for me by putting it in the oven. I was really intent and extremely upset when she wouldn't put it in the oven. And I can visualize it still. It was like 3 little balls piled on each other. But my own experience of making those and the seriousness with which I brought it to her and wanted her to, you know, fire it in the kiln, which to me was like the kitchen oven, and she was very reluctant to put this ball of mud into our oven, and I was extremely distressed that she wasn't willing to do that, you know, but that it was, to me, it was simply reality. Now, let me think, where was I going with that? I lost the thought. I have no idea why I was saying that, so I'll have to go on from something else. A memory of previous lives? No, I think I'm just lost. But I'll find something interesting to say. Just give me a minute. I think what I was talking about is the inner willingness to divorce ourselves from all those different identities. You know, we're carrying so many. We carry so many. We just have no idea. And it's not possible to do violence to those memories. It's not possible to say, "Oh, this is what I should do, therefore this is what I will do." In the early years of Ananda, in the very early years, the first time we started a monastic order, which was in 1971, and it lasted until about 1981. And there were two kinds of people involved in that, and it's very important in this new reality also to know that. There were those who genuinely knew that it was an appropriate timing to relinquish the accoutrements of outward involvement with the world. And then there were those who thought they should want to do that. And it was just two different realities. And the should group became so big that in the end it was actually necessary to dissolve the monastic order because the whole community was falling into one of those places where the spiritual path is all about how God really doesn't want me to be happy and I need to cooperate with that. It's called over-scrupulosity in the Catholic Church. I fell into it myself, and I remember Swami, the only thing I can say is pleading with me. Asha, God doesn't want you to be unhappy. It is, I made the spiritual path so narrow that I was really in very serious danger of falling off of it. Because we can't just take that deep identification with the ego and that belief that this is where our happiness lies and say, no, it doesn't, no, it doesn't, no, it doesn't. The only way we learn is by giving ourselves to life with wholehearted enthusiasm. And not every individual impulse is a negative one. But what we have to act in this world is we have to act with the willingness to be profoundly and deeply conscious of the effect of our actions on our own consciousness. And we have to have the courage, whatever that courage looks like, to be completely sincere to our own actual experience. I mean, that is the single greatest challenge on the spiritual path, is not to have reason follow feeling. I want to be like this, therefore I am like that. I went through these several years with Swami Kriyananda, as he put it to me later, just trying to be such a good devotee that whatever he asked of me, I would say, yes, sir, yes, sir. And I had no capacity to follow through. It was all just, this is how I should behave, this is how I will behave. And after about 2 years, when I was in just such a mess, he said to me, and I loved it, you never fooled me. That's what he said. Your consciousness vibrated who you were, and your words were just pasted on top of that. But it made it impossible for him or me to actually work with my karma as it was. I thought it would be more fun to try to work out someone else's karma. Someone who didn't have the impulses and the thoughts I did. I'll just make up a whole set of them and I'll try to work out those. You know? But the spiritual path is honest. The spiritual path is courageous. The spiritual path is not personal. We don't try to say, oh, look at my wave. My wave doesn't have really any ego left, does it? Do you notice how my wave doesn't have any ego in it? Look at my wave. It has no ego, right? Swamiji said he worked so hard on his humility. At one point, he said he became proud of being so humble. What God loves us for is not our competency, not even our spirituality, but our deep sincerity to stand where we are and bring in more light. You know, David and I have taken a very significant step. Maybe some of the others of you will be inclined to take a step in relationship to this. Have the courage of your convictions at least to entertain the idea and to talk to us about it. But above all, what we're trying to represent by going in this new direction is each one of us, let us stand where we are and recognize that who we are doesn't matter. You see, part of our concern about our position and whether we take this vow or that vow or what we do is that same ego identification. God loves me if I do this. God loves me if I prove this is my level. God loves me if I get to wear this new color. You know, it's just not true. We can't get away from God's love. There's nothing bad enough that you can do that could ever break that tie. The only thing that happens is we open ourselves more or less to it, depending how much we cling to our individual reality. That's the heart. It's the spiritual path is so simple. As many as received him, to them gave he the power. It's so simple. But in order to receive that, even if we see ourselves just as we are, we don't have to identify with it. Do you see the difference? So here I am. You know, this is what I want. This is what I do. This is what my past karma has brought me to. You know, this is how this particular wave is manifesting, but I am one with the infinite sea. And in that joy, Yogananda's poem, Samadhi, which I quoted from earlier, ends with the phrase, a tiny bubble of laughter, I have become the sea of mirth itself. There's a recording of Yogananda saying that. He says, a tiny bubble of laughter, I have become the sea of mirth itself. Say it with me. Say it again and again. A tiny bubble of laughter, I have become the sea of mirth itself. Again, again, he says, a tiny bubble of laughter, I have become the sea of mirth itself. Isn't that glorious? You see, all that we're renouncing, all that we're giving up is our limitation that we call freedom. Like little children, we play in our dollhouse and claim it's the whole world. Well, outside of that, God says, come, my child, You are one with the infinite. The tiny bubble of laughter become the sea of mirth itself.